to revisit the Fairs Committee meeting in room 315 at 3 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday, May the 28th, 1975.
Meeting, and we'll have the work session after we get through these bills, and hopefully the committee members will be here by then. House Bill 2305. Is it Eleanor Blundell?
Senator, is it all right with you if the chairman of our board comes up to
Sure.
Okay.
If I didn't know you, I couldn't read your last name.
We're neighbors.
I started to look at it, and I looked up at you, and I figured, well, that was right.
Senator Roberts and members of the committee, my name is Eleanor Blundell, and I am the administrator for the State Board of Tax Service Examiners. And I'd like to introduce the chairman of the State Board, Larry Scheer, from Portland, who is a tax consultant. Okay.
Would you like my address?
I'd like for you to identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Lawrence Scheer of Milwaukee, Oregon, chairman of the State Board of Tax Service Examiners. As it may be known by the committee, the original Tax Service Examiners Law, which requires all persons in Oregon who prepare returns to be licensed, was enacted by the 73 legislature, and it became effective on January 1st, 1974. The original law was primarily patterned after the real estate law, and while it possibly worked very well for the real estate people, we found in approximately 2 years of working with it that it was not adaptable to our type of field. Therefore, we are requesting these various amendments. Most of them are administrative in nature and designed to help reduce the possibility of restriction of trade in some instances, reduce the amount of red tape and paperwork that the board offices had to work with. We have attached to the handout a breakdown of what is included in the present law and the amendments that we're asking for, and if I could be of assistance in any way by answering your questions, I'd be happy to do so at this time.
Has there been any opposition to the bill since you've introduced it? Was there any in the House?
There was one opposition, and we have removed that in the amendment, which was to remove the exemption of the enrolled agents from, right now they're exempt from this law. And we were going to include them in the law, but now there's no change now. That's back the way it was originally.
Okay. Because I have no one signed up except the two of you. And so I have to assume there's no opposition, but...
Senator Roberts, it passed the House with a vast majority. I think there were 9 no votes.
Okay.
Which makes us very happy.
Are there questions from the committee? Senator Burbidge.
In your statement, you say that most of the amendments are technical. Will you point out the substantive amendments to us?
All right, sir. For example, the first one... requires a tax consultant employed by another tax consultant.
Identify where you are.
I'm on the first one.
First page?
I'm on Exhibit A. What amendments would do?
Okay. All right, proceed.
All right, the present law requires any tax consultant employed by another to surrender his license and obtain an associate tax consultant's license. The amendment would eliminate this associate status. It really doesn't serve a function at all. It simply seems to be a way of identifying whether or not a consultant is in fact in business for himself or works for another person. And with the real estate field, I'm sure there are important applications here. We didn't see any advantage in our case at all. It just seems to add to the paperwork and confusion. The second one allows a tax consultant to act in the capacity of a consultant when and where he wishes. As presently stated, you're more or less enslaved to work for one individual, and in certain areas of the state, In the more remote areas, this has posed a problem. They have not had tax consultants to avail themselves of simply because he was working for another individual. And this would give the individual tax consultant the flexibility to either work on his own behalf or work in conjunction with another tax consultant. The third one allows a tax preparer to act in the capacity of a preparer as an employee of only one tax consultant. The same thing applies to two, also to the preparers. Preparers, up until this point in time, have been required to work only for one employer. And we didn't realize when the original law was drafted how common it was in this state for practitioners to swap help, so to speak, during the busy filing season. And we've had, as a matter of fact, complaints from licensees in this respect that they're working for one tax consultant who isn't busy enough to keep them busy, and they can't go down the street and help the fellow out down there. So it has tended to restrict trade somewhat, we feel. We would also be issuing the license directly to the licensee rather than to his employer. And then he would carry the license with him wherever he worked. The present law requires that the employer must display this license in his place of business, and each time a status changes or an employer terminates or an employee terminates, he has to send the license immediately into the state. It has to be reissued back to the new employing consultant. Again, this creates a lot of paperwork and administrative problems for the board office. And it is rather confusing to the businessmen out there who are the ones who have to work with it. On the back page, what we've done is try to eliminate the need for corporations and partnerships to be licensed. The individual who's responsible for the preparation of the return, the one that we would look to in case of a problem, is the one who would be licensed.
Mr. Shear, why have you, on your sheet here that you've given us on the amendments, apparently at one time you removed the exemption for those persons who had practiced before the law went into effect, and then you
Yes, we did request that. There are approximately 100 enrolled treasury agents in the state of Oregon. Now, an enrolled treasury agent is one who takes an examination at the Internal Revenue Service.
That's the amendment that you were talking that you were speaking to.
Right.
Yes, and since they were not licensed by any other state agency and were not required to have any continuing education, we felt that they should be covered by our law, but it didn't work out that way.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Move to go out.
No, we need 5 votes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A lot of
tomorrow
came in.
Yeah. So that's Melissa's watching the television in the background there.
Well, he's only 4th vote, so we have to wait till we get some members to take motions on this thing. We'll come back to it. Okay, let's go to House Bill 2309. James Kincaid.
What's the timing? Small arm.
Chairman and members of the board for the committee.
I'm Jim Rice.
My name is Jim Kincaid. For the past 8 years, I've been owner of the Taggart School of Beauty. I'm not anymore, having sold it last fall. I can speak with quite a bit of knowledge and authority on the present bills that are in front of you people in this committee. There is three of them relating to the cosmetic therapy.
Let's just stick to this one right now, if you don't mind.
The 2309.
Yes.
I'm against it, of course. It's very poor legislation. I'm sure that Mr. Wilhelm who sponsored the bill. If Mr. Wilhelm had ever spent a day in a cosmetic therapy school, he would not have proposed this bill.
In defense of the sponsor, whose name I think you're really taking in vain, many legislators will accommodate the constituent and introduce a bill whether or not they agree with the principle. And that is a way of the public getting an opportunity for an expression. And for, in all due respect to you, sir, and what you've stated, it's just inappropriate to make a suggestion that Representative Wilhelms may totally agree with the concept here when he may not, and he may have done that only as a concession or an accommodation to a person. And this is...
Well, thank you, I accept that.
Let's proceed with your testimony on the bill, please.
To have one teacher for only 50 students is ridiculous, because practically everything that happens in the school is direct instruction. It's almost a person-to-person thing. It is at that particular time. Now, if we are to have only one instructor for 50 students, and it can be an emergency, I'm very sure that there will be schools that will be probably having emergencies most of the year. So how can a student learn with only one instructor if we go up to 50 students? I'd like to read you a letter. There's been pressure brought on this state board before, and here is a January 22, 1973 letter from the State Board to Jerry Birch, President of the Oregon Beauty Schools Association. It says, "Dear Jerry, a letter of January 2, 1973, petitioning Oregon State Board of Cosmetic Therapy to interpret OAR 300503B as written, with the exception of the word enrolled, changed to the word president, present, was acted upon by the board at their meeting on January 10, 1973. Which, of course, is a direct violation of the statutes. When you go to 691-235A, it says, 2, this is speaking of instructors, 2, if it has 30 or fewer students enrolled. B, one additional teacher for each additional 20 students enrolled in excess of 30 or any part thereof." Of course, this letter is a direct violation of the statutes, because it's changing a word, and I know that this has been done. They're talking about the administrative rules here, which are in direct violation of the statutes. Now, if the board will not obey their own laws, how can they expect anyone else to obey them? If we're going to have an emergency thing here, I repeat that we will have constant emergencies all the time. And that will not be good, because a student is going to be cheated.
Are there questions, Mr. Kincaid? All right, while you're there, Mr. Kincaid, you're the only person signed up to testify on 2309. Let's go to 2992. You're signed up to testify on that one also.
Yes.
So will you turn your thoughts to that one?
I don't hear very well. I'm sorry.
Would you
like to have 2992 now?
Yes.
Fine. Of course, you people have 3 bills regarding cosmetic therapy here, and my pleading, of course, was that you would reject all 3 of them and place this in an interim committee where it can be surveyed and come up with a revision of the statutes that is will be fair to everyone. Now, to 2992. On page 2, I am 23. 18 years of age has dropped and had as now will read has completed 2 years of high school or the equivalent. This means that there can conceivably be licensed hairdressers in the field, or cosmetologists at least, in the field at the age of 16 years.
How long does it take to go through the school?
Well, if 2536 were to go through, we're speaking of 350 hours for a cosmetologist. If you stick to a hairdresser, they're speaking of 1,800 hours.
Tell me that in terms of weeks or months.
1,800, well, the 2,500 hours we at the school always gave an estimate it would take 15 months. But a student can come out of grade school at 13 years of age.
This doesn't say grade, well, all right. Pretty difficult.
Yes, it is. But what? How long does it take to get the equivalent of 2 years of high school?
Six. They start school at age 6, and it takes 8 years to get to high school. That's 15. 2 years in high school.
Well,
then you're going to keep them in your school for a year.
That's not a big point. I just wanted to comment on everything as I go through. Then we go down to the line 32 on the same page, as prescribed by the board. In my working with the board these last several years, that words of that type scare me. I'm wondering what prescribed means, and does it mean by rule? And also, if there are, in 2536, it mentions by rule, is this indeed in some way an end run around Senate Bill 381? I'm rather curious as to whether it might work that way, possibly. Next. I want to skip clear over to page 6, on line 8. And this is a deletion of the present statute. It says, furnishes a certificate from a physician licensed by the State Board of Medical Examiners that it is free from contagious infective diseases. Now, of course, the only valid reason for licensing is for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Now, how in the world does a deletion there? And then, in conjunction with this, let's go back to page 4 on line 27. And this is one of the reasons that you can deny a license or refuse to renew it or so forth, when he says that he continues to practice while he knows he is afflicted with an infectious or contagious disease. Those two are not consistent. How in the world is a person to know whether they have some of those things that they can pass on to the customer if you're going to eliminate? I know there's another bill, there's 2311, which is in the State and Federal Affairs Committee, to delete everything that has reference to the physician's certificate from the physician that he's free from contagious disease. Now, on page 8, they have eliminated two on line 29. There is an elimination of two graduates of the same school of cosmetology shall not be members at the same time. Yet, I hope I'm not lost in that. Here I'm trying to refer back. Yes, on page 315, line 15 says, examination shall not be confined to any specific system or methods. The graduates from a school, now when they speak of systems and methods, a method is something that is taught in a school or a system, and there are franchise systems that one school can have and the other schools cannot. Line 31 on page 8. One member shall be the owner of a school of cosmetic therapy, and they delete that he shall be a licensed member. I would like to read now from the book Occupational Licensing. It's based upon a five-year research study undertaken by the Educational Testing Service for the Manpower Administration of the U.S. Department of Commerce, of Labor. It is copyrighted in 1972, which brings us up to a very current time. I'll read from page 235. Says one member shall be the owner of a cosmetic therapy over a school of cosmetic therapy. Schools offering training in licensed occupations and teachers in such schools should be regulated by the State Department of Education rather than by the board which licensed practitioners in each occupation. In several fields, notably barbering, cosmetology, practical nursing, and dental hygiene, the licensing agency usually has the power under its legislative mandate to set the criteria and standards for the physical plant, the qualifications of teachers, the duration of training, and even minute details of the curriculum. When one considers the composition of licensing boards in these occupations, one cannot help asking, what qualifications do board members have as educators? What do they know about facility standards, about teacher competency, about curriculum? There is little in the background of most board members that would qualify them in these fields. One might even question the wisdom of including on licensing boards the owners of proprietary schools who have an economic interest in such matters as the duration of training or the requirement that a student who fails a licensing examination must return to the school for additional training at a fee. On line 33, three members shall be public members not licensed under this chapter. I would like to read from page 230 of the book, under 7. It says, how can the public interest best be represented on licensing boards? It says, the obvious way to provide for public representation on licensing boards would be to have the governor appoint one or more laymen to serve on such boards in order to represent the public. The New Jersey Commission on Professional and Occupational Licensing took this approach, and efforts are underway now to to achieve similar reforms. Now, of course, we have had for 4 years now two public members on this board. Does California, which already had one public member on most of its boards in 1970, has since then increased the public representation to two members? This approach may not be the answer. One of the reasons for suspicion is the very equanimity with which the suggestion has been received by associations representing licensed occupations. In New Jersey, when the legislation to include a public member on each board was introduced, the leader of the state assembly was quoted by the press as saying that the proposal is definitely okay.
Mr. Kincaid,
he called it another phase of consumer protection.
Let me interrupt you. We have many bills to hear today, and we have many people to testify, and I'm going to limit everybody, not just you, in terms of the amount of time that I allot to them to testify. We know all about public members on boards. We've had the bill here, and we've debated with Senator Burbidge's bill, and so I don't think we need to know any more about public members on boards. We've debated that issue here long and hard. Would appreciate if you go on to other provisions of the bill that you're concerned about.
I was hoping I'd find out your attitude toward it.
You may have to stick around a long time to find that out. Are there any questions, Mr. Kincaid? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I have other parts to speak on.
Well, you're taking an awful lot of time, Mr. Kincaid, and I've got a whole, I have a whole page full of bills here and everybody waiting to testify. We're rushing everybody in the whole Capitol building these days. It's not taking it out on you, but I just simply am going to limit the time for everyone who's testifying.
Did my
throat get some response?
My
throat got some response. But I would repeat that this testimony, I think, is very relevant, and I would hope that this board would turn down these bills and place an interim committee where that we could come up and draft a decent.
There'll be some other people testify on this bill who have the same position that you have.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Wilhelm, did you want to appear on 2305? 2309. Yeah, 2309. Okay, we'll go back to 2309 for Representative.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for missing this commitment, but got so wrapped up in reconvening in the House that I'd forgotten the note on my calendar. House Bill 2309 was submitted at the request of a constituent who ran into a problem in that an instructor legitimately could not report for work one morning due to an illness. And it happened to be a morning when they were inspected by the board and they were written up for having fewer instructors on the premises than they were required to have. This complaint was relayed to the board, and the board did take action administratively to straighten this out, and I understand there is now an administrative rule that would enable a school to get around this problem. We felt that it would be good to codify this, so we introduced this bill. Now, I'll admit, I understand there was some comments made about the way the original bill was written. The 50 should read 15, not 50, students. And there should be 10 days written in the blank. But be that as it may, the bill was amended on the House side and compromised quite significantly. And it comes to you in its present form out of a spirit of compromise and does, I think, deal with the problem, not as well as I would like to personally see it, but I am reasonably satisfied with the way the bill is now written as amended in the House on April 10th. So I would only be here to answer any questions you might have and encourage you to pass the bill out in hopes to keep this problem from happening again to any other.
One short question. When the inspector told them the man was sick, were they informed why the instruction was there that they were sick?
Yes.
And they still went ahead and...
Well, yes, Senator, but in defense of the board, I would say that they have to enforce the law the way it's written, and the law was very arbitrarily written before. So they had I guess no choice but to write up the school at that time. Now they have an out by administrative rule.
But you feel you want it in the law?
Yes, and that was the feeling of the House Committee.
Let's stretch it along a little bit. I'll tell you, I've inspected for a long time.
Questions of Representative Wilhelm. Thank you very much. Appreciate
you
coming over to explain it. Deanna Kinsey, did you want to testify on this one on 2309? Okay, I don't think so. I think you're pretty well informed. All right, we'll go back to 2992, Gene Smith. Hopping all over here. Gene, I'm going to limit your testimony too, so.
Talk fast.
Yeah. Say probably you can't. Back to 2992.
My name is Mrs. Gene Smith. I'm from Hood River, Oregon. I'm the president of the Oregon Heritage and Cosmetologists Association. We do not oppose, by the way, 2309, the way it's written. If you want any testimony on that, I didn't sign it for that. I didn't see it.
You don't oppose?
I don't oppose 2309. The reason that I don't oppose 2309 is Representative Wilhelm is correct that there has been so many problems with these small schools, with some of their teachers being absent from sickness, and they don't have as many instructors. And because the board has come in and given them bad marks, there has to be something done. However, the board did, by rule, say that they could bring in somebody as long as there was one teacher. And I could go into that at a great length, which I think the board could be a lawsuit on them over that. So what this actually do, 2309, will be to make the state board of cosmetic therapy legal. So I'm all for it.
Okay, now let's go to 2992.
Now we'll go to 2992. I would like to make a comment that this is the first time there's been a hearing on this, too. There was no hearing in the House of Representatives, and we just knew about it yesterday, and so we are violently opposed to this bill. There are very few things in
here. Was there a hearing that you were not informed of?
There was not a hearing on 2992. There hasn't been a hearing on 2992 at all. It came out on the floor. On page 2, I just got this new endorsed bill, and so I won't even say the page because I'm not sure, but it would start out with the 045. 691045 relating to the hair pieces. Now, in our law as it stands right now, we don't have any control over the wig salons, so therefore we have placed in the law some way that we can control and be a protection of the public, and that was to at least have them put the sanitize their combs and brushes in where they're selling wigs, which is merely a protection of the public. And therefore, we're opposed to this because they're trying to take this out. On 060-691-060, reciprocity, we feel that there's a lot of people that are coming in and there's lots of complaints that we do not have any true reciprocity between the states. I feel that there should be a study on this between the states, and I think that there will be. We're going back to National in July, and we're having a committee meeting and trying to set up something so that we can put in a good reciprocity. On 691071, under examination, 691245, qualifications for entering school, and 691261 are all, that's the license to teach, and all of these are dropping the age limits. We feel that 17 years of age is soon enough to get into a school. 18 years of age is certainly young enough to be out in the field. We have no law now that provides that you have to be a certain age before you can own a salon, or even that you have to be licensed to own a salon. So therefore, if they're going to get out of school at 16, 17 years of age, they can still be getting out of school, owning a salon at 16, 17 years of age. Who's even liable for that? Their parents. This is, we're opposed to the age limit. And certainly 21 years of age is young enough for a teacher in training. So we're opposed to that. We go down to 691300, which is on your page. Back up a little bit. On page 5, on the 691226, we are not opposed to anything that might go into the Oregon Women's Correctional Center, the Hillcrest School of Oregon. We understand that well, we just understand the problem there. We are not opposed to any of that. We know that there has to be something on this. On 691-300, we have the temporary licensing on page 8 of your bill on line 13, a temporary license. The licensing of this premise would stop a lot of educational functions, which are vital for the existence of our licensees. This law has been in existence for, I would say, safely say 30 years. It has never been enforced. Only up until the past year did the board decide that on any educational functions, like the affiliates have shows and they bring in guest artists, and we have a trade show which attracts 2,000 to 3,000 people, and it's just the past year, in 1974, they have decided that we needed a temporary permit for each of these persons that were going to teach. We felt that this was a little out of line. We felt that it was maybe, some persons even thought that maybe it would be a little bit of harassment. So we felt that if they would put into the law, make an amendment and put into the law that and any educational functions, that we shouldn't be taxed for that. Actually, it would even stop some of the small affiliates. Let's say Hood River, the Dallas, for instance. If we were to go down to the village to have a show, and I would maybe put on an educational part, then I would have to send in to the board and get a temporary permit for doing this, and I wouldn't be getting any money for it. So it's taxing me for doing that for educational purposes. I can't understand the reasoning for that. So when we came into the representatives, we did talk about this temporary premises, and the board had $100 a day on that, and we did talk them down to $20 per day, and I still think that the $20 per day, they were thinking of the big shows, like the trade show, and so they would license the premises, like we have always at the trade show at the Hilton. And so they licensed that Hilton for 3 days, possibly, and no more than, or just $20 per day. But I think they have lost contact of these small little affiliates that cannot afford that. So we feel that this temporary permit, there should be something done, but we'd like to make amendments that any educational, for educational purposes, that we shouldn't be taxed for that.
Jane, did you say you appeared in the House Committee on this?
No, there was, this was... This temporary premise came out of alternate 2 or something like that, and it was in 2536 to start out with. They had talked about it, but they were going to have a housekeeping bill.
You talked to House members of the House and changed.
We talked amongst ourselves with Diane
President,
and between the board and myself, Mr. Snook, and two of the rest of us were talking about this. There was a legislative council member there, and I can't even remember what his name was now. We did talk about that. They wanted more money. He felt that
okay, let's go on to the other point, please.
Yeah. Okay, and then we'll go down to 691, and of course, you had said about public members, but we were the first board that to have public members on our board. And now this is asking for actually 4 public members, because it has 3 public members, and then the school owner would be unlicensed. And so then we have 4 members on our board that are unlicensed. We are opposed to that. There should be amendment on this that we would like to have that... On 691-310, it said under our law, existing law 691-310, on page section 5, it says a board member appointed under paragraph B of subsection 1 may not act as an examiner under this chapter. Well, that's the school owner. But since then, they have put on public members, and then they did not put add to that the public members should not be examining. And I myself walked in the other day and saw a public member examining, and not written. It was a practical examination for a teacher, and I highly oppose that. 691-34 is for sound recordings, and we think that, this is a good thing. This was our suggestion to put in sound recordings, but I also realize under the public meeting law, under 192.610, that it should be taken care of under that. That there should be written minutes of all its meetings, all the minutes available to the public within a reasonable time, and the substance of any discussion on any matter. So we really shouldn't even, we like this part of it, but it isn't worth it to let this bill go through. We feel that there is a lot to be said on this bill. We feel it definitely should go into an interim committee and have it studied by both parts. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer any of them.
Questions?
Just one. I'm really puzzled. Does the Board of Cosmetic Therapy, so constituted without any contemplated changes, does that board make the, do the grading of examinations? Is that what that board does?
Yeah, the board was set up, by the way, our Herbicides Association, clear back when they started out, was the one that started the licensing board. We feel that the Board of Cosmetic...
Well, you're not answering my question. My
Do they examine?
That's right.
Yes, sir.
The applicants for license.
Yes.
On the whether or not they've their examination is based on whether or not they've learned what they've been in school to do, like any other examination. Is that what it's based on?
I'm not sure what your question is. They have to be licensees to be on the board, and only just the last legislation did we have two board members put on there. It's always been the board members were there to administer the law and to examine the examinees. And so they were all, that's why they were licensed. But it was put into the law that the school owner couldn't examine. Did I say something was wrong?
You sure misled me. If the public members that don't know a damn thing about the cosmetic therapy are grading somebody else on how they well they did in school, then that certainly is not the intention.
That's what it's been. That's what I'm saying, sir.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you.
Mr. Hanson? And you will be brief, won't you? Bob?
Senator Roberts, ready?
Didn't hear what I said. I said you will be brief, won't you?
Senator Roberts, members of the committee. Yes, I'll be very brief. The only one section is at 691-310, and we feel that the makeup as the present board members aren't is probably much better than this way. I have right now, if this was, amendment was to go through, you'd be overloaded with people who just weren't cognizant of the beauty trade. And I've just put a few notes down here. There would be too many people on the board that don't know a thing about the beauty business if that amendment was to go through. You would have three and possibly four, that's what Mrs. Smith just said, that wouldn't know anything really about the beauty business. Now, one other thing I think it hasn't been brought up, but in the present bill, you have to be licensed under A, B, and D to be a member of that board. Now, under the present, if this was amended, that wouldn't necessarily be so. You could end up with three or four manicurists on the board. And so, really, the public and the industry, I don't think would be taken care of in this situation. Now they have two public members, and there are four that are qualified to give the exams at the present time because, of course, the school owner can't. I can see the reason for that. So four out of the seven can, but if you add another, if you put on another public member and then the school owner, of course, can't, you would leave three. And then, like I say, under this law, it would be possible of amendment that you wouldn't really have people that were qualified under A, B, and D to give the exam. And so, in that case, you'd have to bring in people, which, of course, would be more expensive, again, to the board. So I think that section really is very bad. Thank you.
Questions?
How do they generally feel about the whole bill?
Well, I'm not particularly, I didn't want to get into that too much. I think that... personally, I think it's been stated before. I think everything practically should be in the interim committee. thing.
Are you a school operator?
No, I'm a secretary of the State Barbers and Beauticians Association, which is the union branch of the barbers and the beauticians. But I do feel that there are a lot of changes, and what affects one does affect the other, and we really, it's a mess right now, really.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor. Let's go to House Bill 2652.
I think we better have a proponent first to tell us what the bill's about. So how about Gene Johns?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is E.K. Johns. For the record, I represent Pacific Northwest Bell Telephone Company. I have given a copy of my testimony to the clerk prior to the meeting, and I have additional copies if they would be desired later. I have a prepared statement, which I'll read to you. House Bill 2652 amends ORS Chapters 456 and 457, which deal with housing authority and urban development laws in Oregon. Sections 2 and 4 of the bill would provide that utilities, either publicly or privately owned, should not be forced to relocate, remove, or readjust facilities without fair and reasonable compensation. Subsection 2 of Sections 2 and 4 state that the Public Utility Commissioner shall arbitrate disputes arising out of negotiations between renewal agencies and utilities. Section 5 excludes urban renewal and housing authority projects that are approved before the effective date of this act. And this was an amendment to the original bill. The purpose of this bill is to make clear that the rights of those who have property devoted to public utility services that are required to relocate or otherwise be displaced by an urban renewal project are on par with the rights of any other resident or business that is displaced by such a project. As you know, if a citizen's home or business property happen to be included in an urban renewal project or is being taken over to make way for a public housing project, the owners of such property are classified as displaced persons and have to be compensated and assisted in finding new locations and accommodations. Some of the cities and renewal agencies around the state have taken the position that they either do not have the authority or do not wish to compensate utilities for their loss of investment and the expense associated with forced relocation of utility facilities. Consequently, costly negotiations are entered into in some cases and settled, whereas in others, court action is required to reach settlement. A statewide uniform statute is needed to clarify positions of the various parties involved and assure uniform treatment throughout the state. The problem encountered by the utilities is that they have a franchise or other agreement with the cities that requires utilities to relocate at their own expense when required to do so for any reason. PNB has always moved within the public right-of-way at its own expense for such purposes as accommodations of city utility facilities and street widening projects and so on. However, when relocation is made necessary for some use not related to the public right-of-way, such as urban renewal, PNB has demanded payment. It has been our position that the cost of development for private interest should not be borne by PNB customers. These costs can be recovered by the agency from federal funds. Reference the Housing and Community Development Act of 1974, or the tax increment process as outlined in ORS 457-440, or by including these costs in the final sale of the developed property to private interests. With these options available, why should the utility ratepayers be required to stand these costs, which further drive up their rates? Why should downstate customers have included in their rates the cost of renewal projects in Portland when, in fact, these relocation costs can be financed in other ways? It is one of the major purposes of bills in the legislature and laws to provide certainty in the affairs of citizens, to establish a rule that all citizens can plan their futures with confidence and stability in the rule. This is why this bill is needed, to put to rest the continuing conflict between renewal agencies and utilities over their right to be compensated for relocation costs. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Questions, Mr. Jones? Guess not. Thanks. Senator Cook.
How are these difficulties resolved now? By court suit?
extended in some cases by negotiations between the parties, and in at least one case that was settled at one court level is now and is being appealed at the court level.
What is this going to accomplish? This would be mandatory arbitration before the Public Utilities Commission?
No, it would not. Only in those cases when there was a dispute between the utility and the Urban Renewal Agency in terms of what the relocation cost should be, then the Public Utility Commissioner would arbitrate the dispute as provided in the statute.
The present court remedy is not sufficient. You could enter into an agreement to arbitrate now.
Well, of course, one of the remedies under the current situation is, of course, the courts. That's always a solution.
Why is it that arbitration is called for here as it distinguished from any other situation where there's a disagreement?
The arbitration referenced in this bill was placed as an amendment to the original bill because the feeling was that, at least on the House side and some other folks, that the establishment of a cost by the public utility was purely a one-way street. That is, the utility could identify the cost of the project, demand payment for those costs, and carry the requirement for those costs all the way to whatever court level they wish to resolve it. Some of the House members and other folks concerned with this kind of legislation felt that there should be a negotiation point or an arbitration point prior to the court process.
In the present time, the Public Utilities Commissioner has the authority to advise you of the costs.
I understand that he does. Not necessarily advise us of the costs. We would, the public utility would arrive at the cost. However, the costs are kept in accordance with uniform accounting procedures established by the Public Utility Commissioner. This is why some folks felt that the Public Utility Commissioner would be in a good position to identify what the costs were based on accounting procedures that he would require and does require in the Cabadeta County.
Now I'm trying to get it straight. Now, at the present time, is there no procedure for this, or is there a different procedure other than court, other than the ordinary one of negotiation?
There is no other procedure. Negotiations currently are the only process. And, of course, when negotiations break down, as they have on occasion, then the court process is entered into directly, if the parties so choose.
Questions? Thank you, Jim. Looks like we have the utilities lined up on one side and three or four cities lined up on the other side, so we might as well take all the utilities first, and then we'll hear from the cities. Mr. Stanbridge?
Senator Robertson, members of the committee, my name is Clancy Stanbridge, and I appear before you on behalf of General Telephone Company in support of House Bill 2652. This measure will allow utilities, either publicly or privately owned, to recapture those expenses associated with moving or relocation of facilities involved in the urban renewal projects in our state. We feel House Bill 2652 is a protection for our customers statewide because utility customers in Gresham or Portland or Beaverton should not be expected to share the cost of urban renewal in Eugene, Coos Bay, or LeGrand. If a city in Oregon chooses to enact an urban renewal project financed by or with federal dollars, we feel that the utility-owned property should receive the same consideration as any other class of private property. We feel the bill, as it comes to you, is fair and equitable for all concerned, and we ask your support. Thank you.
Questions of Mr. Sanders? Okay, thank you, Clancy. Doug Hatter? I presume you're for it. You didn't know?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Doug Hatter, and I represent Portland General Electric Company. We are here in support of this bill, 2652. So rather than go through my statement, I think Mr. Johns and Mr. Sandridge has covered it very well. We only want to echo what they have said, and we support the bill, and if there's any questions, why?
Okay, other questions, Mr. Hyder? Thank you. Mr. Norville?
Madam Chairman, in the interest of time for the committee, Mr. Richards is here from Eugene.
I object.
He was going to go on next. You want in with you?
Well, I thought that we kind of divided up what we were going to say so we wouldn't overlap, and we perhaps
okay.
could make a joint presentation, and he really had the general.
Former Representative Richards may join you.
Former Representative. Thank you very much.
I see him twice in 3 days, so that's too much.
I'm
going to
take you home.
Why doesn't he get along like he does, Senator Howard?
It makes me feel bad.
I'm going to be in your position sooner than you think, Senator Howard, when it comes to hair going fast. My name is Joe Richards. I'm the attorney for the Eugene Renewal Agency and have been for about 7 years. The point of this is to explain to you what a drastic change in the law this bill makes and how it's completely different than most of the other states handle this. The utility companies are here attempting to get a privilege that's not allowed by the common law, that is the judge-made law in any other state except Michigan. And if I recall Mr. Hamill's testimony the last time, there are either 13 or 14 other states that have some kind of compensation for relocation, which altogether means there are 35 states that do not compensate utilities in this kind of a situation. The facts in Eugene are typical. We had a hotel site, one whole block isolated for a hotel site. Pacific Northwest Bell's utilities go underground, above ground, through the alley. This plan has been in effect like 7 years now. The city then moved to vacate the alley, made no provision for compensation last summer, which meant that Pacific Northwest Bell had to pull out the facilities and go into the adjoining street. In 1971, they renegotiated the franchise. This is 3 years after we have the plan adopted. No change was made in the words that whenever the facility shall unnecessarily inconvenience the public or the property owner, PNB shall be required to relocate. No mention about compensation. Now, the issue here is why didn't the utility attempt to bargain or change the ground rules or clarify whether or not they would be entitled to some kind of compensation? The second point is that we've just completed a circuit court case where Judge Helen Fry has ruled that Pacific Northwest Bell is entitled to compensation. So you have a rather strange contradiction. If, in fact, they are entitled to compensation for this kind of a move, then this bill is totally unnecessary. In my opinion, that will be reversed on the Court of Appeals case that is now pending, and I'll explain in just a moment. But if she's wrong about this, it does emphasize what a drastic change, in fact, the bill makes. This places the cost on the back of local government, because while there was some mention about there are federal funds available, there were under the old law. You don't have the two-thirds, one-third match anymore. You have the Housing and Community Development Act of 1974, and there'll be lump sum grants to communities to use as they see fit, but no special provision for reimbursing the agency. It'll come out of the local taxpayer or those districts. Now to the question about the common law. The cases are almost uniform, except as I say in Michigan, that the franchise does not give the utility company any special location in any street. And therefore, when they are asked to move to another part of the street or a different street, there is no requirement that they be reimbursed. When the city asks the utility to relocate, it's exercising the police power, that is, governmental powers, because it's for the health, benefit, convenience of the public. And any time they exercise the police power, they're not required to pay. They are not taking property, so there's no requirement for compensation. Furthermore, these police powers cannot be contracted away. And more they find cases where even where a city has agreed under some circumstances to pay for relocation, when it goes to court, they say the city had no power to contract away its power to use the police power, and therefore that it may still do that without compensation. So when a utility lays a conduit or puts up a pole, it takes a risk in any city that it, if it's required to for the public necessity, then it'll have to move it at its own cost, and that's one of the prices for having a monopoly on this kind of service. Now, the present law is an ORS 221-420. This bill doesn't refer to it, but it clearly gives each city the right to contract on the terms with which a utility occupies a street, or any other utility occupies the air above the street or the alleys or easements. And that's in addition to police
power. What's the number of that statute again?
The number of the statute is 221-420. Now, this bill, in effect, takes that away without any mention in this bill, and in fact, you're trying to take away that power. So, and I'll conclude this, there are two really big questions here. And one is the policy question. Are you going to shift from the ratepayers to the local taxpayer? Whatever the utilities might say, that ratepayer group is still a much lower group or smaller group than the general taxpayer. And why should you extend the privileges that private utilities have now? What is there in this bill that is in the public interest? And why upset the law adopted by the United States Supreme Court in two cases around the turn of the century, and by Washington, California, New York, and I can cite those cases to you, or we've just completed our brief. I would be glad to go back home and just mail you 28 pages of citations which show that to be the uniform law, including the state of Oregon. In about 1959, we have a Clackamas Water District case, Highway Commission against the Water District. Water District was told to, they changed the highway, and they were told to move their lines at their own expense, and the Supreme Court required that they do that without compensation for the reasons I have just mentioned. It's a clear exercise of police power. They're entitled to do it. The final issue, then, is the constitutional one, and that is, can the state, on behalf of cities, bargain away their police power? There are also cases that say that states cannot bargain away their police power. And that's what, in effect, this bill is really doing, that regardless of the purpose, public necessity, there's still required to be compensation. There are some specific defects in the bill itself, and that's what Mr. Norvell will address. Do you have any questions about these?
Madam Chairman, I have.
Senator Schmidt.
Joe, I evidently don't understand this bill. It looks like to me that this bill drops in the Public Utility Commission as an arbiter, and that the cities or the utility have the right of appeal under Chapter 183. The only difference being that you have one more step in the appeal question. Is that right or wrong?
Well, I don't. It may be right or wrong. I don't see it that way, and the reason I don't is that while we're in court right now on a case, I have a strong feeling the court will find there just is no right to compensation under these circumstances. Now, this bill would strongly suggest that there is a right for compensation by just flat out saying it, that they can't relocate, that is, City of Eugene could not require a relocation without fair and reasonable compensation. It gets very cluttered up after that with the word may include cost because it doesn't set a standard. But, no, I do think it's different than, it is more than just a step. If you put an administrative agency step in here, whatever the utility commissioner finds, then really can't be appealed to the court unless it's arbitrary or unreasonable under the Administrative Procedure Act.
Well, then, are you saying that you oppose the first instance in any case of the PUC commissioners being the arbiter in the question of anything,
if there'd
be one constitutional between utilities and the urban renewal agency?
Yes, and for reason Mr. Norvell mentions, I think that's a particularly bad choice, but my main reason is that there should be no arbitration procedure at all. If the utilities continue to think under the present law that they're entitled
to some kind of compensation, let them take those cases to the court. Because,
well, I think that's what I got back to, and I'm trying to get at the reason that you fear an arbiter, because the question, ultimately, if there is opposition, we'll get to courts anyway, obviously, and under this bill or under existing law or common law, which you quote. The only difference and change that I see is we've got a PUC arbiter in it, and that's the point I'm trying to get at. Why is that bad?
Let me say that, first of all, it isn't really the choice of arbiter or even subsection 2 of section 4 that's the big problem. The section is with section 1, where it says that they shall, or they cannot, the city cannot move or require relocation or removal without fair and just compensation. That's the principal change in the law.
Section 2, sub 1 you're talking about.
Well, that's section 2, sub 1, and section 4, sub 1. See, section 2 applies to chapter 456, which is housing authorities, and section 3 and 4 really apply to urban renewal, which is chapter 457.
How does the word may in section 7, in line 7, how do you read that?
I read that
an authority shall not require. How do you read the may and shall in that?
Well, the may induces a great amount of ambiguity, because if it says may, does that mean that they shall at least give the cost of replacement plus installation? Or does it say this is the very maximum that can be given? Anytime you leave a discretionary, first of all, you have to have a legislative test to make this constitutional. And anytime you put may as to whether you use the test or not, on the face of it, looks unconstitutional as written with the may in there.
Well, because it appears as though they're inviting the arbiter to me, and then if there's objection, that the appeal procedure's there. That's what it looks like to me.
It looks like that, but normally what a legislature does is set out the test. It'll delegate some of its fact-finding duties or whatever to agencies, but it normally will set the ground rules. This, the line 21, does not set the ground rules.
This is not a normal legislature, Joe.
Normal one is Republican.
Madam Chair.
Well, there is another point you haven't brought out, but don't you think that it's significant that I believe that the utilities are allowed to use these roadways without any rental whatsoever?
No. The franchise agreement in Eugene provides for 3% of the gross revenue.
That's a franchise, but that's just because the city does it. Basically, in this state, the utilities are allowed to use the public roadways without any payment. Now, they can later be required to pay a franchise, but in the cities. But, in other words, the right to use is apparent, as I recall, an absolute right to use the roadways, isn't it? They don't have to pay any rent.
Are you talking about out in the county outside the city limits, for example?
Either. There's a distinction. I mean, I think we need to make a distinction, do we not? One is the right to use, the right of utilities to use the public right-of-ways without charge. I don't think the city or the county or anyone else can say to the telephone company or the power company, if they want to put it underground, they have the right to put it underground, essentially. They don't pay any rent. I guess they maybe have to make an application, but they have the right to put it underground. That is the law, isn't it?
Well,
now, the counties have a right, the cities have a right to exercise a franchise, but the counties don't. At this point, only the cities have the right to impose a franchise tax because of this public utility monopoly law that we passed about 10 years ago.
I think that's a correct statement.
Well, I mean, I think it's just important to recognize that these utilities, they own the facility, but they don't pay any rent, and never have for God knows how long in Oregon. So the burden is not as though they bought an interest or paid rent when they came in, and they moved out in without paying the public anything for the right to use it. It was given to them years and years and years ago.
Other questions, Mr. Richards?
I just wondered.
Senator Hard.
One month, can a highway contract they contract with the utilities and pay the cost of moving. Only we passed a bill a few years ago covering that. They go through with the freeway, they pay the utilities for moving poles and...
Okay. I was not aware of that, Senator. In fact, the existing case law in this state, based on the Clackamas County Water District case, is that they are not required to pay the utilities cost removing and relocating those facilities because they're at the state's exercising its police power for the public necessity and convenience.
Mr. Norville, do you want to add anything?
Yes, I'll try not to overlap too much. Some of the questions which were raised cover some of the area that I will cover. My name is Oliver Norville. I'm the attorney for the Portland Development Commission, which is the urban renewal agency for the city of Portland, and have served as legal counsel for them for 17 years. And I'm presently serving as legal counsel, and I'm here on behalf of both the Development Commission and the City of Portland opposing this bill. I wanted to cover really three areas and try to avoid overlapping Mr. Richards. First of all, the experience in Portland with negotiations in connection with relocation of utilities. Two, the bill itself, the inadequacies we see in it. And three, some amendments that were proposed have been considered. We would propose not to have any bill at all, but if there is to be one, we would we have some proposed amendments. First of all, experience in Portland. I think those of you who are from Portland or the Portland area or have been in Portland are familiar with the South Auditorium Project area. I know Madam Chairman is. It's her office is there, and the Development Commission has carried out that project. It has carried out the Emanuel Project, which is presently being carried out, and some smaller project. We've had our negotiations, and this goes to Senator Cook's questions, with the utilities have gone on over a period of about 15 years since the South Auditorium project first got started. And we've never had litigation. We've always been able to work things out, to reach compromise agreements. We've taken the position that they're obligated to relocate. They've always taken the position that they're not, but we have been able to reach terms. I'd like to give you a few specific examples. For instance, in connection with the South Auditorium Project, one of the major costs, if there had been in that project of relocating the building, was a major steam line that comes from PP&L steam plant, which feeds down 3rd Avenue. If the PP&L had been required to relocate that line, it would have cost them a very, very substantial amount of money. The telephone company, Pacific Northwest Bell, had underground utilities that went along 3rd Avenue, which was at that time a street. We drafted the plan in such a way that, that the malls which presently exist there would accommodate those existing underground facilities and they would not be required to move. The utilities, on the other hand, voluntarily remove the distribution lines, and there's never been a question about distribution lines in the project area. They've always removed those without any question whatsoever. The problem has always been with transmission lines or underground lines, where they're major costs. In the Emanuel project, we have negotiations with PGE on, and we have had negotiations with Pacific Northwest Bell. The telephone company, we have resolved that existing underground utilities. We resolved that by agreement with them. They did some relocation work, which was requested of them, and then they were permitted to retain by agreement all existing underground facilities which are presently there. With PGE, it's a question of where they're to relocate, and the nature of the facilities, there's some complex problems which are involved with those relocations. But we are negotiating with them, and I think both sides are trying to reach some kind of an agreement in good faith which will solve the problems for both the city and for the utility company and minimize the cost. PP&L has relocated transmission lines in the Emanuel project without question. They've not opposed it at all. So what I'm saying, our experience in Portland has been that
over a period of about 15 years, we've been able to work with utility companies to resolve these, both sides working in good faith. I think this has always been true. We haven't always agreed on everything, but they have been resolved, and we hope that that would be so in the future. Concerning the bill itself, I saw the bill this morning, really, as it was revised from the original bill for the first time, and although I didn't know its general contents. And my response to that is that it's a very simplistic response to a very complex problem. As I mentioned, you're talking about distribution lines, transmission lines, underground lines, replacing them in a different place, improving the facilities, upgrading the facilities. And when you come down to talk about remove or readjust without fair and reasonable compensation, that's a constitutional test. And there's case law which has gone on since the beginning of this country, which has been attempting to determine what is reasonable and just compensation for a private taking. And it seems to me that in connection with relocation of utilities, you'd have to develop a brand new vast body of law. And when you talk about the use of may, I don't know how a court would look at that. May include the cost of replacement of the same or similar facilities and the installation thereof less salvage. I hate to be the public utility commissioner trying to construe whether or not the legislature intended us to do that and not to do it, and what other factors should govern. It's an inadequate standard, in my opinion. Mr. Richards alluded to the public utility commissioner as the arbiter. I believe that we would prefer the courts. I think that if a vast body of law is to be developed in this area, it would be best done there. Public utility commissioner, this president happens to be a neighbor of mine, I'm very fond of him, but he may not be impartial because he's concerned with keeping rates low and not necessarily additional costs which may be imposed on the city. And we kind of are concerned about the public utility commissioner serving as an arbitrator in connection with this, with a kind of a vague standard to deal with. Concerning proposed amendments,
before it goes on, may I ask?
Surely.
Senator Smith, sure.
I really would appreciate you directing your response to the very question of dropping in the PUC commissioner as the arbiter. Now, your discussion about the courts doesn't wash because you still have the right of appeal in 183 and all the court and the whole court structure. Now, I'd like for you to direct your attention to dropping in the PUC commissioner as the arbiter on the front end with the appeal procedures back in the day.
Because the 183 is the Administrative Procedures Act, which means that upon a finding or determination by a public utility commissioner, it can only be overturned by an arbitrary or unreasonable finding by the public utility commissioner. With a court determination, they take a brand new, fresh look at this thing. I mean, it's a de novo. They start from the beginning. They don't look to whether or not the arbitrator, the public utility commissioner, had any basis for his findings. They look to the substance of the matter, and that's the reason.
Well, except just one other point. Except when you go through 183, then you finally get to a court with the same question before it. Is it unreasonable? Is it unreasonable or arbitrary or not?
Oh, no. Yeah. It's entirely. It's whether his findings are arbitrary or unreasonable. Mm-hmm. When you go to court, you question the substance of what is fair and reasonable compensation. If he's made some kind of a determination along some kind of lines, which the court can say is not irrational or is not unreasonable, then he's upheld. A court would take a brand new look at what that said, and they would define it themselves. That's what the courts always have had with the acquisition of public bodies. I do have some proposed amendments, which yeah.
Yes, please, Hannon. Connie.
Okay.
I keep doing it myself.
We feel the matter should remain as presently stands, subject to the laws that presently exist, or as the courts may find it to exist, and that the bill should not be adopted at all. But if it is, we feel that the proposed amendments do some of the things in defining what kind of value we're talking about in terms of what is fair and just compensation. And it also provides for equally sharing the costs, public agency and the utilities themselves, and having the utility certify as to the cost. When a public facility goes in, which is publicly owned, it goes out to bid, and there is the price can be determined. When a public utility company puts materials in, it puts them in according to its own accounting practices, according to its own ways. It does not go out to bid. It uses generally its own workforce. So it's very difficult to determine the cost when a utility does the work. At least that has been our experience. These are not all of the amendments which we propose. These are some that are the substantive part of it. Additional would be to remove the public utility commissioner as the arbitrator, and a very minor one in Section 5 is rather technical. Line 28, what it refers to, apply to housing authority projects, to insert or urban housing authority or urban renewal projects for which urban renewal have been plans have been approved.
And this one's off.
That is.
When you replace a facility, there's no value on that facility. If I dig up a power line, an underground power line, there's no value on it besides salvage.
That's correct.
Well, how then the value and the difference between the replaced facility and the value of the...
It's when you're relocating, when you're putting in a new one.
But they've already got that line. Once they dig that up, that's not worth a dime to them outside of salvage. Why should that be in there? Why should that be considered?
Not
sure. Once you tear down my house, I can sell the lumber for salvage, but the house is still not worth a dime to me. You've got in there, and the value of replaced facility shall be considered. The difference between the value of the replaced facility and the value of the replaced...
Let me read it, and if I can...
Am I reading that wrong?
I think maybe you are, Senator. Shall share equally in the cost of relocating, removing, or readjusting high voltage, again this is limited, high voltage transmission lines or underground utility facilities and services, including the cost of replacement with the same or similar facilities and the installation thereof. In other words, putting in the new facilities, that's where you start from. Less salvage, that's what you're talking about. Less salvage and less the difference between the value of the replacement facilities and the value of replaced facilities. Now, you may be replacing a 50-year-old line with a brand new line.
But how much longer is that line going to last?
Well, that's the question.
Yeah, I'll say that's a question. That's a major question.
Well, there's nothing in present bill which begins to even give any guidelines whatsoever except that provision which follows May. Here, at least, there's an attempt to provide guidelines, and that was the purpose of it.
But once they did that lineup, as far as the power company, they've got the metal that's left there. What was done in that ground is not worth a dime to them.
That's
just like the tear my house down.
Whatever the wire is worth, you're correct. That's all it's worth is the salvage value.
I don't want to give either side any advantage here, but if I dig up a pipeline in front of my house and put a new one in. The only salvage I get out of that damn thing is the metal that I dug up out of the ground.
That's precisely what this amendment says. It says it's the cost of the new installation, less salvage, if any. I mean, if there's no salvage, there's no salvage.
Well, that's all.
It's the cost of the new installation reduced by whatever the reduced value of the old facility was by reason of its age or use. You may be replacing, as I say, a 50-year-old line with a brand new line, and you're giving.
I can't see how anybody is going to arbitrate out what the value of that line is. It didn't have to be moved, and it's laid in lead. It may stay there another 75 years and still operate unless the company has to.
Let me give you an example.
I don't think that's quite. I wouldn't think that was quite fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, number one, Mr. Richard says our position is that they're required to relocate anyway. Number two, our position is that if they're to be compensated at all, that there should be a formula worked out which accurately reflects the value which was lost. That's what we're trying to do here. And the example I'm going to give you is in connection with the Emmanuel project and our present negotiations with PGE. They presently have a high voltage transmission line which runs down right down to the middle of the project, which runs right over the new entrance to where Emmanuel Hospital will have its main entrance. And it's fairly important to properly carry out that project and make it something.
Well, it's awful hard to look at that really up there in Northwest Florida. I think you had that.
Well, this is going to be a beautiful project sometime. But the problem is that line has to be moved over to Vancouver, and a new line put in on Vancouver. There are existing transmission lines along Vancouver. PP&L has lines along there. PGE would either have to put them on the same poles. They would be placing those new poles in Vancouver. The cost of placing those new poles in Vancouver, plus any salvage they got from the lines that presently run along Gantenbine Street, if any. I mean, there may be no salvage value. Less whatever the reduced value of the, by reason of the use
well,
of the
I could tell you what an old telephone pole was in its lifetime, but
this is just an attempt to work out some fair form.
That's sort of tough to tell.
This is not limited to urban renewals. This will affect every city and county in the state, will it not?
Well, it appears to relate just to urban renewals.
Mobile?
Yeah. In other words, it wouldn't relate to any other kind of public project, and that's really kind of an anomaly because urban renewal can only be carried out in blighted and deteriorated areas, and it appears that the law will be, if this is passed, that you have to compensate them in old and blighted areas, but you don't if they're in new and good areas, which you're requiring them to relocate because of a street modification or something of that nature. And to me, that's somewhat of an anomaly.
What is their rationale? I don't remember any testimony from them on why this should be the case in an urban renewal area, but not the case otherwise. You don't know?
Well, I suppose that their rationale, I don't like to speak for them, is that probably it's been a bigger problem to them in urban renewal because there's been a more substantial change in the utility lines in project areas than in other areas. But the principle is exactly the same. And Senator Howard, you may be correct about freeways, but in the testimony before the House, the gas company testified that the last relocation that it had done was referring to this bill was a freeway relocation. And it quoted the cost of relocating a gas line in a freeway, which had nothing to do with urban renewal. And so, you see,
if you were going to be absolutely fair, wouldn't the Public Utilities Commissioner have to rule that the ratepayers in that urban renewal area would be the ones whose rates would have to go up, not the rest of the area? I mean, not the rest of the county or town or whatever you're talking about.
I don't know about that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say this. It's a little bit like the ratepayer in Eugene calls and uses Portland's facility in completing a long-distance call. You know, it's very much, we are pretty interested in what's happening in the Portland area, for example, and costs that ratepayers have there as well. So I don't believe it's still called for a shift from the ratepayer to the general taxpayer, which is the effect.
May I make one more comment, because I think it's very important with a response to a comment made in testimony by the utility companies, that is that this can be paid out of federal money. As this committee, I'm sure, is aware, the Urban Renewal Program as such is terminated. A lot of the categorical funding programs were terminated and placed under the Housing and Community Development Act. Under the old law, under the old federal urban renewal law, there was a provision that if the city had to require the utility to relocate, it would pay for it as project cost. That meant you went into the deep pocket of Uncle Sam and got the money out. At the present time, and under the present law, it probably is true that you could use some of the housing community development money to pay for relocation of utilities, but it comes out of some other program. It comes directly out of a fixed sum that comes to the city, which cannot be increased and set by formula. It comes out of housing rehabilitation or paving of streets or some other program which would otherwise be utilized under the Housing and Community Development Act.
Okay,
another
question, Senator Cook. We have one more witness, and then we've got a long
The shift
question.
Would be from home to home if this were passed. The shift in cost would be absent the federal consideration from whom to whom?
From the utilities to the city.
To all of the city or just to this limited area in the urban renewal area?
Just an urban renewal area.
And how is the urban renewal area of development financed? By specific taxation in that area or by general taxation? Throughout the city?
Well, it's changing right now. It's most, in the past, most projects have been financed through federal funds, two-thirds of which came from the federal government. That law went out of effect last year, and a new bill came in, the Housing and Community Development Act. I presume that most major projects will be financed through federal funds under the Housing and Community Development Act would come out of that, those funds. Now, there is, as you are probably aware, there is a provision for tax increment financing in project area where the increased values from the project area itself pays for the costs of the project. But those can only be limited to very particular cases where you're going to have a very substantial increase in value. And generally would not apply to, for instance, neighborhood projects. We're carrying out rehabilitation, we carried out a neighborhood improvement project in the Albina area, which where utilities were split. There was overlapping of facilities, they were split. I think it was the first time it had been done in the city of Portland. A tremendous number of poles and lines were taken out, which really weren't needed at all. And those were paid for by the utilities. We're working more in neighborhoods now than ever before, much of the emphasis on rehabilitation of housing and improvements of declining neighborhoods, and this is so it would be primarily federal funds we're talking about coming from a fixed pot that can't be increased. So the cost is shifted right to the city, right out of the city's pocket.
Thank you both. We've got to get on with the other witness. I can't read the name, but it looks like Bud Akers. I'm not sure. City of Salem.
How long are we going to go?
Well, we've got a work session as soon as we get through this bill. We can pull five members in here.
My name is Bud Alkire. I'm the Urban Renewal Administrator for the City of Salem. I'll make my comments very brief. I'd like to begin by pointing out that as the bill was mercifully amended by the House, it probably would not have a substantial impact on the City of Salem, primarily because of the provision in Section 5 exempting existing plans from the provisions of the bill. I think to clarify that, the suggested amendment by Mr. Norvell to include in line 28 there, urban renewal, which I think is the intent of the House, would clarify that even more. despite the fact that the bill would probably not have a significant impact on us, Salem is opposed to this bill. The first proponent of the bill discussed existing law regarding displaced persons and tried to indicate that there is some type of analogy between a business or a resident of a renewal project who, when required to move, is paid full relocation benefits. To my knowledge, we do not have a significant number of people living in public rights-of-way under franchise, which is what we're talking about in this bill. To the extent that we have, and the City of Salem has, been involved in the taking of real property belonging to utility companies, they are paid relocation benefits. We are just completed a $600,000 acquisition and relocation program with a PGE substation located about 10 blocks south of here. So when we do take real property, we do compensate under the provisions of the law. What we're talking about here is utility lines within the public rights-of-way owned by the citizens of the City of Salem. I think from a policy point of view, we're quite concerned about the impact this would have in the future when you're talking about the fact the city has the right to require this relocation as it's under the laws of the state of Oregon, but it would not have that right under this bill in urban renewal projects. I fail to see where a case has been made that renewal programs have been carried on with some degree of lack of sympathy with the utility companies, that we should make a special exemption in renewal project areas to provide the special benefit for utility companies. To conceive of what would happen would be if a street improvement was being put in one part of town, as you drive along the city, any that you see probably requires some degree of utility line relocation. That would not be covered by this bill. If for some reason it happened to be in a renewal project, then it would be covered by the bill. I think the problems of trying to deal with urban blight and trying to preserve our housing in our downtown areas and the commercial and retail nature of our downtown cores, not only in Salem but in Eugene and Portland and the other communities of our state, are complicated enough without burdening the city with a special benefit package for private utilities in those companies, in those areas. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions, Mr. Alkar, is that right? Thank you very much. Let's turn to these bills on work session now. Let's take up House Bill 3027, starting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We've got five of us. Let's start at the bottom down there, 3027.
3027.
Last bill in your book. This is a bill that continues to grandfather in television repairmen. There is no conflict between the two television repairmen groups. They are in great harmony now, apparently.
This continues to grandfather in.
That's right.
I move to send it out due pass.
Okay, the motion is to send House Bill 3027 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Baron, is there a problem on that? I have a thing here on page 2, line 9. This, we keep running across this of good moral character, and I note a question mark here of House Bill 2495. I'm not sure to hang up on it.
That's existing language.
It's existing language.
I don't know.
Did House Bill 2495 change that? I mean, is there,
which one?
I have a note here that House Bill 2495 might have had some effect on it.
Well, why don't we just pass it with the understanding if there's a conflict,
all right,
we resolve the conflict.
Okay, all right.
It's just a grandfather TV
program.
Yeah.
Right. Clerk will call roll.
Is this a work session?
Yeah.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Grimstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. We're going to jump around on this because I'm waiting for Senator Burbidge to get in here before we go to credit unions and And for Jerry to get back on ones that we have amendments on. Let's go to House Bill 2353. Is that the one we wanted on today?
2353?
No, I'm sorry.
Is there anybody here that should be here?
No, I didn't check on that one. So we're going to hold that one. 24. Connie, do you have the amendments on 2498 or 2489?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I'll have to move one. I'll have to move one.
2489.
We don't have a vote for it, Senator.
Sure. We do. I think we do to get it out.
Are you talking about 2353?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, you want to make a motion?
I would move these. Send
2353.
2353 to the floor of the Senate to be passed.
Okay, is there discussion? Clerk will call roll.
Present.
How do you vote?
I abstain.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Drisden?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No.
What do you say, Senator?
I said I was present.
You're right, Freddie.
Oh, so try to... Okay, 2489.
I heard
you. Do you have the amendments coming? 2489.
I can still come up again.
Oh, yeah. You can come up whenever.
Can I give you?
Yes,
I'm here. What are we going to?
21 are we doing?
2489.
Okay, Mr. Christensen, what's all these amendments about?
You I have no knowledge of it.
Where'd
it come from? I wonder.
2489.
It says Norm Howard on mine.
Says Norm Howard on yours. Just
sit
that on mine.
Well,
where'd these amendments come
here
from,
Jerry? I haven't. Just a second. I think those are from the Legislative Council. Oh, okay. I do like that. All right. I can explain.
All right. Jerry will explain the amendments to us. Could you give Mr. Christensen a copy of it, too, please, Connie?
Madam Chairman, what these amendments do are to clean up the ORS chapters. We got a note from Legislative Council that said they've drawn up proposed amendments to House Bill 2489, which removes reference to repealed section ORS 672265 from ORS 672255. No other changes are made.
Well, why did it take them six pages just to change a reference to a statute?
We've got another one that's just as complicated. What happens oftentimes is if one section is removed, they have to rewrite the whole section to renumber it.
Mr. Christensen, do you want to take time to look at them before we act on them?
Yes, but I don't.
Yep, you look at them and we'll come back to this bill after you look at them to see if you're satisfied with them. Let's go to 2684.
Okay, I got a proposed amendment for that.
Okay.
It's a very simple amendment. It's on page 20, line 23 of the bill to change the word one half to one quarter so that it would read that the interest not exceeding 1.25% per month instead of 1.5%, which is 15% per year. And that is the motion I so move.
You want to speak to your motion?
Yes, ma'am, I certainly do.
I think there's quite a bit of difference between credit unions and other kinds of lending institutions. These are members banded together and putting their dough in and borrowing back their own money. They're not competing out in the market for money like other people are. 18% is what I consider, in my own view, an exorbitant amount of interest for consumers to pay for money, or money or merchandise, and many of them use this to go out and purchase automobiles, appliances, and other things. And this rate of interest is consistent with Bank AmeriCard interest rates. The proposed amendment would be at 1.5%. It's what I've been told, even a higher rate of interest than most credit unions do impose or would impose.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Cook.
I was apparently not present when this measure was heard. Can anyone tell me what the argument of the credit union people was with respect to the 1.5%?
Ms. Hughes, do you want to come up?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes, representing the Oregon Credit Union League. Senator Cook, in response to your question, the reason we put 18% in there was last year in the times of tight money, in order to facilitate, in order to have enough money to lend our members, we sometimes have to go outside to acquire that money. Not very often, but sometimes. And we were paying up to 12% for that money, so we put in 18%. I have talked to Senator Burbidge about his concern on going to 18% in the Model Act, and he would rather go to 15. He feels more comfortable with 15. We have no objections to that either. One other change, since our...
Wait a minute. Let's stick with one
excuse
while we're on. What's the current rate?
The average interest charged by credit unions to its members is approximately 10.2% now. That's the average of all credit unions' interest.
Okay,
is there
so
any
this
maximum now?
Is
there a maximum of
12%?
12%.
So this goes up 50%.
So this goes up to 15. This would put you up to 15%.
That's right. Yes, ma'am.
Are there other questions on this proposed amendment? Ted, do you have another amendment to propose?
Wait a minute.
Okay, then let's take care of this one first. Further discussion on this proposed amendment? Okay, the clerk will call the roll on the proposed amendment.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Now, yours.
Madam Chairman, since we made our presentation at the public hearing a week ago, there has been some question about the insurance section of this by the insurance agents. We have just hashed out with them in the smoke-filled room right behind this hearing room. We sat down and we agreed, and their concern was on page 22, lines 7, 8, and 9. The insurance agents and us have talked about this, and our big concern is that we exclude on line 8 property insurance and liability insurance. We have agreed to that. We were concerned that not be left in there. They have some other amendments that the insurance commissioner that you had, Senator Howard, but they did not understand the difference between state and federally chartered, and that was existing language. So they will be comfortable and feel good if on line 7, after purchases of, we strike the word insurance, and on line 8, after health insurance, we strike property insurance, liability insurance.
Who's objecting to this?
The insurance agents.
Why should we give way to them? Why don't you let them enter into the agreement? What's wrong with the present language? Do your members oppose it? The present language?
Do they oppose the present language? Our members?
All right.
They approved the right language as it was initially there, Senator. Yes, sir.
I don't know why they shouldn't be able to do that.
Well, there is some concern, I believe, by the insurance industry that credit unions become a full-fledged insurance, get into the insurance business full-time. That's where the concern's coming from.
Do you think that's a real... What was the original idea of the credit unions in asking for this language? What did they contemplate doing?
May I let Tom Augustine of the Oregon Credit Union League answer that, please?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, our intent in the area of insurance is the same intent as we had when credit unions were started, based on a membership organization trying to find as good a deal as we can for the members of the organization. We have no intent to going into the insurance business or subverting the agency system or the independent agents in any way, shape, or form. And we felt this is what our verbiage originally accomplished. Apparently there is some concern because of this. But we simply want to make varying forms of insurance available to the members based on a membership organization or a large group of people banding together to fulfill their own needs.
Such as what kind of insurance did you have in mind?
Well, currently there are many mass marketing programs which I understand are not always acceptable to insurance commissioners or agents, automobile insurance and a variety of other insurances. Very often we're approached by insurance companies in the area of temporary disability. Years ago, we weren't involved in insurances at all. Generally, we've always tried to take care of our members internally, handling problem areas of this nature. Since we have expanded, we've been approached in a variety of areas. So we want to offer the temporary disability insurances, any other forms of insurance that could be a benefit to the members. Health insurance, again, is getting to be a very expensive thing. And if somehow there could be a group program put together through the existing insurance laws and agency system, then we would like to be able to avail our membership of these various types of insurance. Automobile insurance is another one that varieties of companies are mass marketing automobile insurance throughout the country. So we don't intend to sell. We would like to make it available.
Other questions?
I would move the amendments, Madam Chair.
Senator Powell has moved the amendments as proposed by Mr. Hughes.
That's on the insurance?
Yes. We've got some commas to take out there too, Ted, but we'll clean it up. It should read now on line 7, to facilitate its members' voluntary purchases of disability insurance, accident and health insurance, and legal expense insurance. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right.
And that's what you want to take out?
That's what's left in.
That's what's left in.
What's taken out?
Property insurance and liability.
What I didn't read.
Property and liability. And liability. All right, now, so what's your view as far as property and liability? Do you think...
Well, I'm not sure, Senator Cook. I think the liability coverage, we get into homeowners and a variety of liability coverage, is a very complicated situation. We've talked about this. And currently, we feel that it would be an area that we would be willing to relinquish. We have no immediate plans of doing anything in this area anyhow, and since it is a very complex situation, we would rather take it up at some future time.
Further discussion on the motion. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Cook?
No.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Anything else, Mr. Hughes?
No.
Okay, Chair will entertain a motion to move out the bill.
Move it out.
Motion is to pass up to 2684 as amended. Discussion?
Kirk all for the question.
Kirk will call roll.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
right, I think I'll have Senator Walt Brown carry this. He worked on it, didn't he? Okay, all right, instead of one of the members of the
committee. All that takes 30 minutes?
Oh, you've got a lot of room to talk.
You have second choice.
I'm a backup.
You're a backup.
I'll be in the aisle.
Okay, Mr. Christensen, have you worked out that little problem or not?
Yes, I gave you the money and I agree with the amendment. So
all right.
Amendment.
House Bill 2489. Senator Jern said when was the amendments to, that were presented to us that were technical amendments to take care of the problems of the bill. Any discussion? Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendments? Okay. Now, I'll take a motion on the bill.
2536.
Chair moves House Bill 2489 to the floor of the due pass recommendation as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Gerbich? Is it a good bill now?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, I'll vote aye.
You vote aye?
Yeah.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2524.
Running television. Is this the one that the labor commissioner and the collection agency were fighting about?
This is Farmer Thomas testifying on this bill. Were you the one that was in favor of it? Somebody came over
and
was.
Yes, my favorite.
Okay. Wasn't there somebody from the Department of Commerce who had some objections on it?
No.
Just the bill and you.
Okay. Mr. Rickson? Fred Vanatta proposed an amendment and you objected to the amendment, as I recall. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yeah. Last time I talked to Fred, he says if they don't get the mail, they probably won't bother him anyway.
Yeah, I understand that. I got this confused with the employment agency bill. I leave the malpractice bill out in the
We may come to that soon.
Fred's here now.
I'll do it now.
Okay, Mr. Vanatta, are you still have a problem with this 2524?
Madam Chairman, I presented some amendments that I thought would resolve the problem that I had expressed. And I'm sorry I was in another meeting. I don't hope the amendments have been adopted or not.
No, we just turned to the bill. We're just trying to work on it. Do you have those amendments, Jerry?
The question was, there more than one, and there are three or four companies that operate this way.
There are about five at the present time.
Five.
Four of them are licensed, and the other one is in process.
Mr. Vanatta's amendment was on page 3. You want to refresh your memory? You have good.
Okay. I'll move the amendment.
Okay, the motion of Senator Smith moves the adoption of the amendments that Mr. Vanatta presented to the committee. Discussion?
Madam Chairman, I think this is going to allow about three big, there's a couple little ones, and Fred's one of them. But this allows I think three big ones, real latitude in this operation. And I don't think it should, we hire a and pay the real estate commissioner to test this thing, and in doing it, it just opens up another door that we'll be down here 2 years from now to close.
Okay, further discussion.
That's the amendment you're referring to?
Yes, it opens it. Then Fred didn't even know, when he was here, he didn't know there was, you know, he said he didn't know there was others, but there, well, I'm not sure of that. Maybe you said that, I don't know. But there are some, about three big ones that this would open the door to. I can't support
the amendment. Madam Chairman, we have the collection agency people here. Why don't we let Mr. Venata defend himself?
Mr. Venata,
why don't we hear the ones that, what they could actually do, if you don't mind, from the man that runs the, they're together.
Well, we have forum license at the present time, and when they have complaints and there are questions relative to their operations from either the creditors or the debtors, we have the opportunity to go in and check their records and also to handle the consumer complaints. Should this amendment be passed, that would take these areas, these particular outfits, out from under our observation, and the consumer complaints would, you know, they just bypass. There's nothing anybody could do. It covers, as you say, about three large ones, and we don't know how many more small ones, but it would create a problem.
Well, it was our understanding in drafting the amendment that it did not exempt collection agencies. See, the bill broadens the coverage of the law and brings billing services under the law. And it was our understanding of our amendment, and I think the amendment specifically says billing services, that as you broaden the coverage of the law and bring additional businesses under the law, you do not bring under the law those in-house operations, as you will, that are primarily limited to doctors and perhaps lawyers operations that are all done out of the office. So we don't see that amendment as exempting anybody that's presently registered or licensed with them. Only as they broaden the coverage, these in-house operations would not come under the law.
Well, if Fred, if I put an office at the big doctor's office out in Bridge and did this, would I come under the law? A billing service.
Well,
let's face it, that's a collection agency. A billing service.
It's already under the law. Collection agency.
Well, if you define collection service and billing service, and eliminate them. But now, in a collection, when I bill this class and for my insurance company, this class, it's a collection agency. If you get right down to the, and the real estate and insurance commissioner can control it.
Well, it depends on how broad you define the term collection agency. I think if you read that bill very carefully, you would find that a girl who worked part-time for two employers would be a collection agency and would have to be registered under the Act, as the language that you have before you.
Is that not true under the present law?
Well,
true under the present law,
yes. Yeah, the present law is really more designed to cover, they have billing services in the present language, and that's designed, they define billing services in the Act, and it's designed to bring an additional segment of businesses under the law that there was some disagreement about whether they were covered
the old law.
Wouldn't it be a question of whether this person were acting as an independent contractor or a part-time employee in each of these businesses? That's the distinction, isn't it? If they're acting as a contractor, then they have to be licensed.
That's right.
And if they're a part-time employee, you can have one person spending half-time in my office and half-time in my competitor's office. And as long as they're paid as an employee, that would be perfectly legal.
I do not believe that's correct under the language that's in the bill.
In the present law.
Yeah, in the present law. But that is, you're, I think, correct, Senator, on how they catch our billing service, in effect, our in-house operation, under the definition of billing service that they have here. If we were, in fact, on a salary rather than on a percentage, we would, you know, there'd be no question we would not be covered.
What was the question on the motion?
Question's been called for.
Has there been a motion to adopt these amendments?
Yes, the motion was made to adopt. We were under discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Cook?
No.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator
Jurisdiction?
Aye, aye. I didn't hear Senator Jurisdiction?
Yes, he voted twice.
Madam Chairman?
No. Okay, you want to do anything with the bill?
No, without.
Burbage moves House Bill 2524 is fully to pass. Clerk, discussion? Clerk, call roll.
Question.
Senator Burbage?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Right.
Senator Jurisdiction?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. 2863.
I have a motion, Madam Chairman.
Oh, you have a motion?
Yes.
Okay, name it.
Page 5, line 12, line 13, strike 3,000 and reinstate the bracketed.
All right, start over now.
Page 5.
I have a note here that says this isn't worded properly.
That's incorrect, Madam Chairman. We checked it out, and it does contain the proper language of existing statute.
Okay. And what do you want to do, Senator?
I want to go back to bracket language.
Okay. You want to delete 3,000 and return to 1,000. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. This is for the security bond, isn't it?
Right.
Okay. You've heard the motion discussion?
Madam Chairman. I would oppose the motion. I think the testimony was this would involve $20 or $25 over a three-year period to increase the bonding from $1,000 to $3,000. And I don't see that as a substantial amount, and I don't see it as keeping anyone out of the landscaping business. So I would oppose the motion.
Further discussion?
I don't want to close by saying, Madam Chairman, that the Senator hasn't attempted to get a bond recently.
$25 would keep me.
But that $3,000 bond in there will keep any little landscaper. He could be the best landscaper in the world, but he's poor.
He won't be poor if he's the best one in the world.
$25 divided by 3 would be about $8 a year increase.
But really, that's a bond that he has to put up.
Yeah, and if he skips the country, whoever he shreds and kills gets at least half of them back.
It says a surety bond, and that
might have to post a cash bond.
I asked that question. He can put security in the bank instead of a $3,000 bond. So really, I think that's all right.
Let's talk one at a time, please, and be recognized by the chair. Senator Burbage.
Senator Smith, is this a performance?
No.
So this is a surety bond.
It's a surety bond.
Well, but does it have for its purpose to assure that what he contracts to do for a person at their home or wherever, that he'll complete the job and do what he says he can do? I submit that the cost of doing any landscape anymore, even around a person's home, especially if it's a new place, you can't hardly get a bunch of shrubs and stuff in for less than $1,000. And a lawn, you can't get a lawn and shrubs put in for $1,000.
Madam Chairman, you can build a $150,000 home with a $3,000 bond. And I suggest that landscape architects, landscape contractors don't do business in that kind of volume.
Clerk, call roll on motion.
No overhead.
Senator
Your motion
Irby?
Is to reduce
no.
it from 3 to 1.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator
Jersey?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Move it out, do pass.
What's the carry?
Do it, Jerry. It's a bill all right.
Yes, sir.
I'll move it out.
Heard the motion, discussion?
Question.
Clerk, call roll.
Senator Irby?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator
Jersey? Aye.
Madam Chairman?
House Bill 2950.
How'd you vote?
Aye. Did I say so? I'm sorry. What do we got on this one, Jerry? We've got an amendment on this. This is this little jewelry auctioneer thing again. We just moved the jewelry auctioneer the other day to the Secretary of State.
No, we took it away.
We took it away from the Secretary of State. Now we're going to eliminate it.
This is 2950. How are you
going to do it? We moved the bank up here to these two, and then I'm going to put these cosmetic therapy bills into an interim study and leave this one hanging. Try that one again. I don't know what to get, actually.
When was this bill passed?
Are you going?
When was this bill passed originally?
All premier State and federal affairs
You want me to explain them, Madam Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry.
What this is to clean up the sections of ORS because of the repeal of ORS section 698210 and 698330. You notice section 6 of the existing statute says persons licensed under provisions of ORS 698210 and 330, etc. It strikes that from the existing ORSs, and so they had to renumber the rest of the section. That's all that First Amendment does. Section 3, again, refers to ORS 698210 and 330, and so that is deleted.
You've got to vote on
because this bill repeals it. And the last one is you had two subsections, one of which referred to 698210 and 330, and it deletes that, so this renumbers that subsection. They're simply technical amendments to clean up the existing ORS.
What was the argument given for repealing this in the first place?
2950? Yeah.
What was the reason given by the proponents for repealing it?
Nobody can meet the qualifications for one thing.
Nobody uses it.
Correct.
And any jewelry now can auction off jewelry and just plain old auction. They don't have to have these special provisions for auctioning jewelry.
There's no abuse. So it seemed like there wasn't there an abuse that prompted the legislation in the first place.
Well, we're turning the damn thing over to the auctioneers. They're licensed, aren't they?
They're licensed. Auctioneers are licensed, and they're bonded and all that kind of stuff. and
this
would eliminate a special classification of an auctioneer.
But you still have to be licensed as an auctioneer in order to auction off. This is our friend.
Right.
I move the amendments.
You just wouldn't need a special license for jewelry.
Okay, Senator Howard moves the amendments to the bill. Further discussion? Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendments? Okay. Senator Howard moves to House Bill 2950 to the floor.
Okay.
I did. Then you did.
As amended. Clerk will call the roll.
I'm staying.
Aye.
Senator
Howard?
Aye.
Senator
Powell?
Aye.
Senator
Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jersey?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
I'm not moving this now.
We've got to go back to the landscape bill. We missed an amendment on it.
Why don't you take a second for a vote?
Well, let me clean up the landscape
bill. Let's get that landscape bill.
2863, there was a...
We got moving too fast.
Yeah. We missed an amendment on it. It's the definition of landscape contractor, and it was presented to us when the testimony was given on the bill, and we just...
We just passed this for now.
I know.
That's why we got to back up. Just
so, I want to motion to reconsider.
I move to reconsider the vote in which we passed this out the floor, and... Also move that we adopt the amendment, and also move to move it out before it be passed.
What's the purpose now? What amendment are you having?
Well, we also move those and play softball.
Okay, the motion is that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 2863.
Aye.
Any objection?
Let me ask a question. Does that say to plan and install lawns, or to plan them, or what? Is that what it means?
Plan and install. Is anyone here from Landscape Architects? Okay. Refresh our memories on this amendment.
Senator Burge, originally it was plant, but as it came out, plan was more appropriate, they assumed, because the rest of the verbiage of the definition did lend to assuming planting and such. And so this definition was worded as you have it there, in the House Committee, and in its the reason for the amendment here is that it came out in air, and Chairman Whelan said, pass it on through, it would be taken care of here because of the shortness of time, and he would testify to that.
Well, but my question is that where do you want in there? Is plant? Your plant. You want
plant. As it is now, plant.
To plan the whole landscape.
To plan and
lay
out the plan.
Many landscape contractors aren't design built. They're not
you
all
don't install a goddamn lawn, you plant.
The motion is on the adoption, Senator Powell moved the adoption of the amendments that defines landscape contractor.
Mary, this is to replace the existing
right.
On page 2, line 13, right?
Right.
That's what they want.
That's what they want.
Very
okay.
I'm a great guy.
And is there an objection to that to amendment?
No.
Now, Senator Powell moves House Bill 2863 to the floor. Do pass as amended. Clerk will call the roll again on that motion.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Did you want to say?
Senator Jernstedt?
Aye.
Senator Sherman?
Aye.
Yes.
Move Senate Bill 225 to the floor, A engrossed version as we amended it had an engrossed.
What bill is this?
Senate Bill 225, engrossed A inversion.
What the hell is it on our list? Is it on the list?
No.
It's not on the list.
Oh,
he's,
not on
the
list. Have we finished with our list?
Oh,
no.
No.
He's fully
guys are going to follow. Not being funny at all. This is the consensus with.
I don't see A engrossed or
right.
A engrossed.
Very simple bill. All it does in the whole wide world is limit maximum rate of interest that can be charged by revolving credit accounts to 15%. Only revolving credit accounts. This is Rosen Starbucks and Sears and Roebuck for you younger fellas. Never heard. heard that term. And that kind, and it makes it consistent with Bank of America's interest rates. Instead of up, there's no statutory limitation on this kind of interest rate, as testified to by the bank commissioner, and they can charge 20% or 25%, and currently Sears is charging 20% on revolving accounts. This is to try to get to it.
Well, what happens to existing account, revolving accounts?
You can't abrogate a contract that's already in effect, but they could no longer charge it after this went into effect.
Martin Franks has a revolving account.
That's right.
And if we, all we're going to do is force somebody that wants to tell Visa's debt from Martin Franks to go to local loan down the street.
No, they won't either. They won't.
36% for...
No way. They won't let that guy out of the door. They want to set him that. Tell them that get it on their credit, and they're going to make dough at 15%, the same as the bank's making dough at 15% on the Bank of America. They won't let him out of there to get far enough to the local
loan. Call
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith? Senator
Jernigan?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Motion fails.
Oh, you'll be great. Okay. On House Bill 2082, we've been trying to get some okay on amendments, and we haven't, so that's not ready to work on. On the cosmetic therapy bills, we're going to put the two big ones into a recommendation for an interim committee study. And so those of you who are worried about... 2992 and 2536. We're not going to take any action on them.
I always got a motion for any three of them anytime you want.
I know you have an amendment, but
I don't accept an amendment. I accept statements that the House Committee asked the committee.
All right.
For 2536.
Okay, Dan. Okay.
We haven't done 3027, did we?
Yeah. While you were gone.
No. What was the action?
Passed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here on House Bill 2536, which is the one relating to the amount of school that a student in beauty school needs. And the reason I was asked to come here by the House Committee is because of a recent court decision which determined in the law, if you'll remember, it says 2,500 hours in a continuous course of study of 2,500 hours of continuous course of study. And it's currently, and for the last 30 years, it was interpreted that this 2,500 hours included hair, skin, and nails. So a student would go 2,500 hours. Judge Olson of the Circuit Court in Multnomah County recently ruled that the 2,500 hours covers only hair and skin, and that if a student wishes to also take classes in manicuring, they must go an additional 350 hours, which would make a total of 2,850 hours. The chairman of the House Committee and I concur, feel that something should be done as a result of this court ruling. The State Board, on the advice of the Attorney General, have revised its administrative rules, and the schools are going to be required to offer 2,850 hours, and I really feel that's excessive, and would ask that something be done by this committee to help that.
I'm not taking any more testimony on any more cosmetic therapy bills this session. Period.
Yeah. May I ask one question? Are you sure that guy got out of jail in 2 days?
I'm going to ask Wilhelm.